All right, so we're discussing, we're continuing our discussion this morning of the laws of logic slash the laws of thought. They are one and the same. So to get things started right now, let's start by doing a brief review of what we discussed last week. And we'll start here by listing the laws of logic. There aren't many, there are only three. And once you've thought through them, they actually seem pretty obvious. So, and I don't care about the order. Let's just come up with all three, okay? Mm-hmm. Who can give me the first law of logic or first law of thought? What's the first one?
Identity.
Identity, thank you. Law of identity. What's the next?
Non-contradiction.
Non-contradiction, thank you. I'll just write non-contra, period, because contradiction takes a long time to write. What's the other one?
Feelings.
Feelings.
Yes.
The law of feelings.
The law of feelings, which is...
feels right.
Whatever I feel is true.
Feelings are the best.
Feelings are... Well, hey, feelings are great. I don't want to think about life without feelings.
Do you light up my life? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Identity, non-contradiction, and feelings. Good feels. Good feels, not bad feels. Okay? What's the third one? The third one's a little bit trickier. It starts with an E, two words. Very good, Ari. Excluded middle. Okay? Those are the three laws of logic, laws of thought. What does the law of identity stipulate?
It is what it is.
Something is what it is. Yes, very good. I picked on Bob last week, distinguishing Bob from, I think, the table or the chair, saying that Bob is Bob, he is not the chair, nor is the chair Bob. Right? The two are not identical. They are distinct from one another, all right? That's a law of identity. And like I said last week, it's kind of, right? Law of identity. What's the law of non-contradiction?
Something cannot be and be, but is the same.
Time and in the same respect. Something cannot be true in the same or false at the same time and in the same respect. That's right. Or contradictory statements cannot be true in the same sense and at the same time. That's right. So I cannot affirm on the one hand Jack is alive and on the other hand that Jack is dead. He cannot be both. That both of those statements cannot be true. One has to be true.
You can't be a follower. You can't be a follower. You are a man and you are a father and you are a son. You can't be your own father.
But I cannot be my own father. That's right. Can't be my own. By definition, I can't be my own father. Right? Cloning raises interesting questions there, but we won't get into that. All right. What's the excluded middle? Law of excluded middle. No middle ground. William?
Something's either true or false.
There is no such thing as partial true or false. It's that any statement is either true or false. Okay? That's what the laws of logic, the laws of thought are. They're pretty simple. Yes, Jim?
Reading a little bit about that this week, I guess now there's some schools of thought where they're supposing that there's varying degrees of truth.
Yeah. Is that coming from Christian sources?
No.
Yeah, and that's because, you know, from an unbelieving, non-Christian worldview, from that perspective, truth ultimately is subjective. And so when your beginning starting point is man, truth automatically becomes subjective at that point. And once you grant truth as subjective, these become subjective too in the end. Yeah, there are all kinds of schools of thought in regard to logic, the laws of logic. There's even resistance to these things, and like I discussed last week, there are some corners now who see these laws as being oppressive because they constrict us. They restrict us, right, in terms of how we define ourselves. And so this whole debate over gender identity and whatever really resists these things. There are different schools of thought out there. You know, this is what they would describe as being Aristotelian logic, And they would say, well, that's not the only way, that's not the only kind of logic. There are other kinds of logic out there. But here's the thing. In the end, at the end of the day, even to ponder those supposed other kinds of logic, guess what three laws you have to use in that pondering to even think about that? These laws. And we're going to talk about that here in a little bit. The inescapability of the laws of logic. Yes.
They restrict how we feel.
Well, yes, they do restrict how we feel.
Right. It's really oppressive.
It is oppressive because the laws of logic, what they do is they cause me to question. Logic, reason, requires me to ask this question. Do my feelings actually correspond to reality? Or are my feelings contrary to reality? And I want to say in my flesh, wait a second, I decide what's real. I define reality. Logic says, oh, I don't care what you want. Logic called, it doesn't
Parents
care.
Used to tell me, I don't care what you want.
Yeah, logic called, it doesn't care. All right. So those are the laws of thought, the laws of identity. Good job. We should all be familiar with these. Are a lot of people familiar with these in modern America? Unfortunately not. Are these things taught and emphasized in our education system?
No,
not really. Not even at the college level. I'll tell you, give you an example. You know, I've been through college and grad school, and I remember my senior year as an undergrad at my private Christian college. Myself, some others on student council, and a number of other professors began to realize, and this is back in the 90s, began to realize, you know what, the students graduating from this college don't have strong critical thinking skills. They don't have a grasp. Starting with logic, basic logic, we really need to, as an educational institution, especially as a Christian one, we ought to be promoting critical thinking. We ought to be teaching our students how to think properly about God and the world. And so we wanted to mandate that there would be a required critical thinking course for freshman orientation. You know, when I was in school, your first semester was freshman orientation. You had to take all these required courses. You're in a big group with other freshmen. And there were required classes as part of that orientation. I don't know how they do it now, but that's how they did it back then. And we wanted to include something like this as part of that orientation, an introduction to logic, critical thinking. And there were a number of professors who signed on and said, yes, we need that. Because what they were seeing in the student body is students who were coming in to the college level, completely unprepared to do high-level thinking, completely unfamiliar with critical thinking or with basic logic itself. And so they agreed. And you know what? Guess what we were met with? We thought, well, this is a shoo-in. This is a college. This is obvious. Who would be opposed to this at a liberal arts college? Lots of people were opposed to it, unfortunately. Especially, unfortunately, a lot of education majors raise a ruckus. Well, I won't say raise a ruckus. That's an exaggeration. They were very opposed to the notion of having a critical thinking course included in the freshman orientation because, in their words, they had enough to do already. It's like, wait, you're going to be the educators. If anyone here should be mastering these basics, these fundamentals, it ought to be you. And yet they were opposed to it because they had practicums and all these other things that were being shoved upon them, which just shows you the emphasis on busy work that often happens in education. Do this ditto, go do a practicum, and little emphasis upon actually teaching people how to think. Do, be busy, but don't think, because thinking's not productive. Yeah, it actually is productive, very productive, okay? So yeah, unfortunately, these things are not widely disseminated, and most of, I think, of our population here in the States are not familiar with these things. And as Christians who are concerned about a T word, what T word are we very concerned about as believers in the Lord Jesus Christ?
Truth.
T. Truth. Truth. Yeah. Truth. We're very concerned about truth. That's why we're having this class. So as people who are concerned about truth, then we should also be concerned with logic and the laws of thought, all right? Now, let's take a moment and reconsider, too. Why do we call them not only the laws of logic, but also the laws of thought? Why do we call them the laws of thought? Very crucial point here. Why are these the laws of thought itself?
Joe.
You can't have a thought without...
Yes, that's exactly right. You cannot have a meaningful thought apart from these principles, apart from these, what we could also describe as axioms. If you cancel out any of these, cancel out identity, for example, where you cannot, you throw out the window the law that a thing is what it is. Say you abandon that, are you able at that point to make sense out of anything? I'll pick Bob. Can I pick on you again?
Mm-hmm.
If I cannot distinguish between Bob and the chair, can I make any sense of the world at all? No, I can't. And so these laws, these axioms, are absolutely necessary to intelligible, meaningful thought. And not only to meaningful thought, to meaningful conversation. Every time you speak to someone and you are expecting them to understand the words that are coming out of your mouth, what are you assuming? You're assuming the laws of logic, all three of them. All three of them. So it's not only our thought that requires the laws of logic, it's communication itself that requires the laws of logic. If we throw them out, there's no such thing as meaningful communication. You can't have it. I can't. Yes, John.
It's funny because I was thinking about the situations where we have done this in the past, especially, you know, in the, not as we see it broken all the time today, right? But, you know, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, people would break these, but they'd use that for, it was comedy. It was laughable.
Yeah.
Because they would, you know, they would twist
yes.
the laws of logic in a conversation, and then it was funny.
It's absurd.
It's like, and
right.
now, that's not absurd.
Right,
anymore.
Right. Now I cry over it.
Yeah.
Right, right. That's a great point. These are the laws of comedy.
Yeah.
Really, there's no comedy if you don't have the laws of logic, because there's nothing to make fun of. There's nothing to twist and to distort in an absurd way that makes you chuckle. Because if you watch funny stuff, for example, you know, what's an example, John, of something funny?
Well, I mean,
first.
The old...
Who's on first? Abbott Costello. Hilarious.
Equivocation.
Right, exactly. That's involving equivocation. All kinds of fallacies that are present in there. Yeah, who's on first? If you haven't watched that, go on YouTube. It's family-friendly. It's clean. It is hilarious. Oh, my goodness. And then Jimmy Kimmel recently did a new version of it in black and white, and it's also hilarious. There's a few tweaks on it, but you should also, Jimmy Kimmel's version of Who's On First from The Late Show, absolutely hilarious, at least for my family and I. You should look it up. But yeah, that's all built on this without, yes?
It's Jimmy Fallon.
Jimmy Kimmel. Jimmy Fallon,
yes.
Thank you. All these Jimmys. What am I supposed to do with all these Jimmys? Jimmy Fallon, thank you. Not Jimmy Kimmel. Don't watch Jimmy Kimmel.
He's not funny anymore.
He is not funny anymore. I think you're a comedian. Newsflash. Stop taking yourself so seriously. Because as soon as a comedian takes himself seriously, guess what? He isn't anymore.
A comedian.
Funny! No longer funny. I'm no longer a comedian. Now I'm a crusader. Comedians are horrible crusaders. Don't be a crusader. Be a comedian. Okay? Anyway, hopefully Jimmy Kimmel, I know, listens to these. So he'll hear that. Okay. Yeah, Jimmy Fallon. So yeah, no comedy without the laws of logic. No fun, right? These are the... Okay, I'm getting on a limb here. These are the laws of fun. But they are, all right? So we can't have intelligible thought without these. We can't make sense of the world. We can't even have a laugh without the laws of logic, all right? So those are our laws. And what I want to talk about right now is they... Let me erase this stuff so I can make room and you can follow by keeping... by keeping track. Whoever got the eraser for me, thank you very much. You know, I could have done it too, but the moment I leave church, it goes out of my mind, and I'm thinking instead about all the other stuff I'm doing tomorrow. So, all right. Right now, we're going to talk about the necessity of logic. All right? And in discussing the necessity of the laws of logic, we're going to begin by asking this question, and that is, are they absolute? Are they absolute? Or are they subjective? okay? Now, we need to define our terms when it comes to absolute. In philosophy and in theology, this word absolute plays a very important role. It carries a very important definition. We hear the word absolute thrown around all the time in a lot of different contexts. But in the context of philosophy and theology, it carries a very particular definition. Anyone have an idea of what that definition entails when we talk about absolute? If you don't, that's all right. When I say God is absolute, what am I saying about him? Yes, Jim.
He's all in all.
He's all in all. That's one way of summarizing it. Yeah. I'm saying God is all in all. What I'm saying when I say God is absolute, I'm saying a few things, all wrapped up in this word absolute. First of all, I'm affirming that God is immutable, and that means unchangeable. He is not subject to change. He is unchanging. So the immutability, unchangeability, is entailed in this notion of absolute. All right? There's more than that, though. So when I say something is absolute, I'm not only saying it's unchangeable, I'm saying more than that. Yes, Joe?
Universal.
Thank you. That's right. Unchangeable and universal. And what do we mean by universal, Joe?
Well, the laws of logic we have here in America are the same ones they have in Japan and
yes.
everywhere else. They apply all times everywhere.
They apply at all times, at all places, for all people. So that's what we mean when we say something is universal. It applies to everything. Do the laws of logic apply on Centauri 4, wherever that is, if there even is such a thing? I'm making up planet names right now. Does it apply out there? Do they apply to the galaxies that are millions upon millions of light years away from our own galaxy? Do the laws of logic apply there? Absolutely. Yeah, so we would say the laws of logic are universal in that sense. Okay? Now, one other thing we mean when we say absolute. Yes, Jason.
Well, I was going to say, I often hear immaterial associated with absolute laws. They're universal, unchanging, immaterial things.
Immaterial.
Is that important to include?
It is, and we're going to come to that. The fact that the laws of logic are immaterial. But before we get to that, eternal is the next. All right, so unchanging, universal, and eternal. No beginning, no end. Okay?
It's
yes.
Relative, the same. I mean, it's not relative.
It's subjective.
Is it subjective?
Yeah,
okay.
And
yeah,
that's
the same.
That's right. So let me throw another word at you for a moment, okay? So we understand what absolute is. Yeah? Everyone got that? It's eternal, universal. Okay, and unchangeable. And now Jason brought up the idea of, well, it's not material. Okay, that's true. The laws of logic are immaterial. They are what we would describe as being conceptual. Right? And we don't want to take what is conceptual and treat it as if it is material. For example, I don't want to say that you can be walking in the woods and then stumble across the number 4. Oh, look, it's the number 4. Not just 4 objects, but the number 4. Does that happen? Can that happen?
No.
Why not? Why can't you stumble? Oh, tripped over 4 there. There, number 4 got in the way. Why can't you trip over the number 4?
It's a concept.
It's a concept. Yeah. Here. All right, I'll give you this little bit here. For those of you who can follow, great. All right? When we take something that is conceptual, like numbers or logic, and we treat it as if it is a material thing, that's actually a fallacy called reification. Reification. And it's one we want to avoid. It's when I'm taking something that is actually conceptual and I'm treating it like it's a material object. We don't want to do that. Yes?
Like chance, and they say chance created the world or something?
Well, there's a I think that there could be an argument made, perhaps, that they're reifying the notion of chance, taking this idea and giving it some sort of potency where it does things, because that's one of the counterarguments against that. Chance doesn't do anything. Chance describes things that we can't explain. But chance is not something that actively accomplishes or does anything whatsoever. So maybe, I've never thought of that before. That's an interesting question. I'd have to think about that, though. Reification of chance, of a concept of chance. That's interesting. So we have the notion of necessity, okay? And when I say logic has necessity, I'm saying it's absolute. Because if something is absolute, if it is eternal, if it is universal, if it is unchanging, then it is also necessary. It must exist. That's what I mean. When I say something in this context of philosophy and theology, when I say something has necessity or is necessary, I'm saying its existence is unquestionable. Its existence is necessary. Does everyone follow that? That's why when you read theologians, especially Christian theologians, we describe God as the necessary being. What do we mean when we say God is the necessary being? We're saying he is absolute. He is eternal. He is universal. He is unchanging. His existence is necessary.
And it doesn't depend on anything else.
And yeah, that's excellent. That's right, Kathy. God's existence doesn't depend upon anything else. That's what makes him the necessary being. And that's what we're saying about logic when we say logic is necessary. We're saying logic doesn't depend upon us. All right? So the other side of the coin from necessity is this word. It starts with a C. Contingent. These are good words to know. Contingent. What is a contingency plan? John, you're in business. What is a contingency plan? I'm sure you have those.
Yeah, so if something goes wrong, you have
You have a contingent plan. But it could happen or it could not happen.
Right.
It's not necessarily going to happen.
Ah. A budget, you can have a percentage that's a contingency part of that. So if something goes wrong, you have a budget.
You can, right. But you don't know for sure it's going to happen. And there's nothing that dictates that will happen. It might happen. Yes, Joe.
It's, in contracts, it's sort of like an if-then statement. So when you have a contract, you have certain things that you have to fulfill in that contract.
Okay.
Some of those things you have to do only upon the happening of some other circumstance.
Right.
So if this happens, then you have to do that.
That's right.
You don't actually know when you go into the contract everything you're going to have to do, because it may change depending on
other circumstances. Ooh, you used a really important word.
Lawyers.
Dependent.
Important words.
Dependent. Okay? So things that are contingent are not necessary. They depend upon other things. Their existence is not necessary. Does everyone follow? They either could exist or not exist. If they didn't exist, it wouldn't matter much. If they do exist, still doesn't matter much. All right? But to be a contingent thing is to be a dependent thing, depending upon circumstances. And if you're contingent, guess what you are not? You are not absolute. You are not eternal. You are not unchanging. You are not universal. You're limited to one place and time. Your existence depends upon things besides you, namely your parents and your grandparents and your great-grandparents and so on and so forth. Okay? You get the idea of what it means to be contingent? Okay. So to be contingent means that your existence depends on other things. All right? Now, let's look at all of us here in this room right now. What kind of beings are we? Are we necessary beings or are we contingent beings? Why are you laughing? Because it's humor. See? Oh, you're using logic, Kathy, because you're
not needed.
You're right.
No reason for us to be other than God's grace.
Well, you're using logic to recognize the absurdity of calling contingent means necessary. That's funny. It'd be funny if I were to say I'm a necessary being, because I obviously am not, right?
Yeah.
So we are contingent beings. We are not necessary beings. If we were necessary, who would that make us?
God.
That would make us God. Yes, Joe.
I'd say men are contingent, but I know a lot of strong, independent women.
Oh, my goodness.
Ouch.
Almost made the coffee come up my nose, Joe. I know a lot of it. Yeah. Who are independent. Yes, right. Heather.
There's always those short stories that try to bolster that idea that we are necessary. Like that one I can remember reading way back in eighth grade where there is that walking down the path and they travel back in time and they walk down the path and oops, they stepped on a butterfly. Yeah. And then they got back in their time machine and then they came back and everything was different.
Yes.
Or saying that we're all one. We're making ourselves necessary. Because if one of us falls, it changes everything.
Yeah.
In the history of the whole world and Earth, universe, we're that necessary. That's our. I'm just saying we have a lot of those. Like when we're talking about that, we think about that.
Self-importance.
We love to talk about
that. Yeah. Well, you're thinking of A Distant Thunder by Ray Bradbury. That's actually the story. Yes. Yeah. And it's an advanced hunting crew. They time travel back in time to hunt dinosaurs.
Oh yeah.
And one of them steps on a butterfly and they go back into the future through the time warp or whatever, and like human beings are completely animalistic and can't even read and stuff like that. Yeah. Did you raise your hand, John?
No, I was just going Bradbury.
Oh, you knew too. Okay.
Oh yeah, I knew that.
Joe, and then Bob. Bob.
Guardian of forever.
The guardian of forever.
Yeah. Star Trek.
That's.
Put the plug in.
Who's the guardian of forever?
It's a machine. They went back in time and changed the future.
Oh, they did.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they had to go back and fix it.
Yeah. As if. Now, there is a kind of assumed absolute there, right? That we have the ability to travel through time and manipulate. There's kind of a notion of eternality there and universality, that we can go anywhere in time and tweak it where we want. That we're not limited to one place and one time and are unable to break those bounds. Right? Yes?
The problem today is we do think we're necessary. We absolutely 100% do think we are necessary.
How so?
In the business world, people who think that they're irreplaceable, number one, because I'm so important that if they got rid of me, the place would fall down.
Yes.
Because that becomes a pride thing that says, I'm worth something. It's all about me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I don't think they'd say, I'm eternal. I'm unchanging. And universal.
I don't know. Yeah.
Therefore, I'm indispensable to this company.
I might be wrong.
Okay. Well, I'd like to meet this individual. If you know someone who actually thinks they are absolute in that strict definition,
well, I think
I want to
think
meet them.
That. I really think that they don't. They're not thinking logically.
Mm. Yeah, they act like they act as if they're that important.
They act as if they're that.
Yeah, that's we're all doing when we sin.
That's the problem.
We're being selfish, rather than the center of the universe, right? And that our desires are more important than anything else.
God needed me. He created me because He needed me.
Yeah,
He was. I've heard that before. Well, He needed me. Isn't that absurd?
That's absurd. Yeah.
I'm sorry, but I've gone on a tangent.
That's all right.
It's amazing the things people will say to you.
Well, it's important for us to recognize that difference between ourselves and God. He's necessary, we are not.
But you can't get anybody to say that.
Well,
anybody that, from the world side, they're not going to say.
Well, they're not going to believe it. They might affirm it on an intellectual level, but they're not going to believe it. But when we understand this notion of necessity and contingency, do you know what that helps us to see very clearly? Grace. It helps us to understand grace. Are we necessary to God? No. Does He need us in any way? No. But did He make us?
Sure.
By what did He make us? Out of, because we deserved it or earned it? No. By grace. He made us by grace. He showed us undeserved favor by even giving us existence, by even creating us, right? So understanding that God's necessary, we're contingent, really key. Even though you might not think in those terms, we're getting a little deep into it because we're doing a study. But that really helps us to understand how what grace is and how God has shown us grace.
You know, I think that when you when someone says you deserve this or I deserve this, that's an opening to saying, why do you think you deserve anything?
Yeah.
To me, that would be an opening to bring this kind of conversation.
Oh, it certainly is. Yeah, people start saying,
I hear that all
deserve.
The time.
Yeah, I deserve it.
Well, I deserve this. Or,
right.
You know, our city deserved to have this done.
Right.
Well,
you know, right. And so when people start talking and using that language, that is an open
that's
door.
An
to, well, how do you know? And why do you deserve that? By what law? By what standard do you conclude you deserve anything at all? All right. So we understand necessity and contingency. I've erased them from the board. Now, when it comes to logic, since logic is absolute, it is therefore necessary. All right? Logic is necessary. And do you know how we can prove that logic is necessary? Very simply. You can prove that logic is necessary and inescapable in this way, all right? That you cannot deny logic without assuming it at the same time. For example, if I make the statement, logic isn't necessary, what have I just done? The moment I say, logic isn't necessary, yes.
Logic has an identity.
Logic has an identity.
Logic is what it is.
And
I'm using the laws of logic.
That's right. And that proves to us that logic is not contingent. Logic is not something that we have just developed in our own heads and used to describe the world. Logic is something that exists apart from man. This is crucial for us to understand as we're going to be answering objections from the faith. And here's why it's crucial for us to understand that logic is absolute and necessary and not contingent. Because what you're going to run into from time to time, not often, but it's going to happen, I think eventually, you're going to run into people who you'll get to this point in the discussion with them, and you'll ask them, where does logic come from? And they're going to say, logic is a man-made idea. Logic comes from us. Logic is a product of the human mind. All right? It doesn't exist apart from the human mind, in other words. It's something we project onto the world and onto reality. Yes, John?
Another way that it's sometimes framed, the way that we're talking about logic here is that the accusation will be, well, that's a Western way of thinking.
Yes.
And
yeah.
There's also an Eastern way of thinking. It's a really good story. I
can't even make that distinction without logic, but anyway.
Yeah, that's right. So there's a great story from theologian Ravi Zacharias.
Yes.
So he has a couple professors that invite him. They wanted him to speak to the students.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the university at all. They were having the discussion, and they were saying, kind of like condescending and almost, you know, patting him on the head. That's, you know, that's the Western way of thinking. Why are you trapped in that
Western,
kind of provincial little thing? And they're saying that's just the either-or way of thinking. There's also both-and. And basically, Robbie comes back and goes, so you're saying I'll either use the Western way of thinking or the
Eastern way.
They're like, well, I guess the either-or does come. So that's an example.
Right. You can't escape logic. You can't deny logic without assuming it at the same time. And this is such an important point for us to understand. Yes, Heather.
Can we just go back one more time? I've been trying to
absolutely
watch this piece of stuff. There's just something that keeps going knock.
Like, yeah, that's why we're here.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
One more time, how do you, by denying the existence of logic, affirm it? If I could just, I think, get that in my brain.
Sure.
Really good. How does that happen?
Okay.
All right.
All right, Joe.
It's easy to use if you use non-contradiction.
Okay.
If you say, if you make the statement, logic is not necessary, you could say, okay, I grant that. So then logic is necessary.
Yes.
Because a thing can be and not be true at the same time. So
yes.
Logic is not necessary, and logic is
that's right.
Necessary.
That's right. All right.
So you can affirm both of those.
That you affirm both at the same time. So let's use this idea too, okay? The idea of a square circle. I'll just draw one for you right now. draw a square circle. Can I do that?
That?
Yeah. Would you like to see it? Who would like to see me draw a square circle? Yeah, all the hands go up. I can't, and neither can God, for that matter. We can't. I cannot draw a square circle. It's not possible. So, for example, saying that logic is not necessary, all right, is the same thing as saying it is possible for square circles to exist. It is possible for square circles to exist. Yes, John.
That's like trying to explain it. Like saying that statement, logic is not necessary, is using logic itself.
Right.
You cannot. Right. You cannot contradict.
It's a logical statement.
It's a logical, statement. So you cannot deny logic, because the only way to a denial is using logic, because you're trying to say this and not that. You're trying to say excluded middle. It doesn't. You know, you're using the laws of logic to say that.
I'm assuming this. Yeah. So with the square circle example, I cannot affirm that square circles exist without at the same time having an established definition of square and of circle. All right? And by definition, those two things are opposites and cannot be the same as the other. Mm-hmm. All right? And so I can't affirm that square... In affirming square circles exist, I'm at the same time denying that they exist. Yes?
This is why it's good to talk about this in the context of our study on presuppositionalism. Because these laws of logic have to be assumed.
They do.
Presuppositions.
Yes.
Presuppositions, by their nature, are unproven assertions.
Right.
You can't prove it without employing it.
So that's right.
Thompson calls them the necessary precondition to intelligibility.
Right, to having thoughts.
You can't communicate or think.
Right.
You know, if I order a cheeseburger and say no cheese and it comes with cheese, there's no logic, I can't say this is wrong.
That's right.
It has cheese as well.
Yeah.
No logic.
That's
right. You can't understand. You can't even order a burger without logic.
That's right. Yeah, so Heather, here's another example. Saying the laws of logic are not necessary is like saying there is no such thing as truth in the end. And so if you're having an argument with someone who is trying to convince you there is no such thing as truth, how is he contradicting himself?
Because he just made a true statement.
Yeah, he's arguing for the truth.
Right.
What he perceives to be the truth.
What he perceives.
Yeah, so he's contradicting himself by making the argument in the first place. I think that's why it was Bonson who said, if his opponents would show up to the debate, he won. And why did he say that? Because what is his opponent granting by showing up to the debate? That there is such a thing as truth. But if he's not going to presuppose God and logic at the same time, then there can't be any truth. And that's why Bonson said, I win. If they show up, I've won. They just don't know that. John.
That's when you say I'd like to yield the remainder of my time.
Let them go on. Let them go on. So Heather, to come back to your question, right? If I make the statement, logic is not necessary, I cannot make that statement without assuming at the same time that logic is necessary. Because I have to use logic in order to make a statement itself. And to expect you to understand it and to affirm it. I have to assume that you and I both agree that my words have the meaning. We have to agree on the meaning of those words, first of all. Right? So we have to employ the law of identity. We have to employ the law of the excluded middle. The statement I'm making is either true or false. It can't be both. And we have to employ the law of non-contradiction at the same time in making that statement. And so that's why we say logic is necessary and inescapable, because even if someone goes around denying it and saying, no, it's unnecessary, they're assuming it at the same time. Does that make sense?
It is. It's just one of those things I think I just need to stay on for a while.
Oh, sure.
I'm so used to not thinking on
these terms. Yeah. We're really stretching our thoughts here. We're getting down to the nitty-gritty of thinking.
Yeah, we just assume, and I don't really...
Yeah.
But then there's a lot.
And it's something that we as believers, according to our gifts and abilities, we need to do it, because we live in a society that is so detached from the truth and rationality. We've got to learn how to have our heads and our thinking stretched in these ways. I'm so glad you're all willing to talk about this stuff. I really am. And let me tell you, I don't mean to flatter you or anything, but I am grateful, because I'll tell you, there aren't many churches right now who would think this is an interesting, important discussion. They would say, can we just talk about loving Jesus? Can we just talk about something else? Can we talk about getting the most out of life or whatever?
That's what we are talking about.
We are talking about that. Absolutely, Bob. That is exactly what we're talking about. So I really appreciate that you're all paying attention and thinking about this. Jason.
Well, yeah, and what we're talking about is glorifying Jesus, too.
Oh, yes, it is.
And answering the objector in a way that glorifies Jesus.
That's right.
But I was going to say that, yeah, that the profound power of these
that's a book title, I think.
Is that it really radically changes the way you think. That's been my experience.
How so?
Think differently about everything. Well, at these fundamental levels, whereas like what Heather was saying, the weakness of evidential apologetics is you grant so much to the objector.
Okay.
You grant him all of his assumptions, which have absolutely no basis.
Mm-hmm.
You grant him the thin air that he's standing on.
Mm-hmm.
You grant him the robbery of the presuppositions that we stand on and actually hold together. You
mm-hmm.
give him all of that
mm-hmm.
in an attempt to persuade him, whereas presuppositional cuts all of that out and will not budge mm-hmm. from recognizing that you're standing on nothing except my worldview.
Let's just for a moment, we'll end on this note. There's more to talk about because we still haven't gotten to your question, Bob, from a few weeks ago. How do we go from saying logic is necessary to saying we need God to have logic? Crucial question. We'll come to that next week because there is a very clear answer to that. But I want to pause and close on this note because you brought up a good point. You use the word evidential, all right, and you called it evidentialism or evidentiary. I don't remember which. But you use this word, okay? And I don't know if everyone here knows what you're talking about. So describe briefly, what do you mean when you talk about evidentialism? What is that?
Well, evidentialist apologetics would be the objector, how do you know the Bible's real? How do you know God is real? And so you immediately begin to try to offer up evidence that
okay.
supports the probable existence of a God.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So you're never arguing okay. for the true God of the Bible, but the probability of a God
mm-hmm.
by offering evidence.
Jason used a key word, probable. And this ties right back into that whole discussion of necessity and contingency we just talked about, okay? Evidentialism, it's the apologetic approach where we say, well, given all of the evidence we have available to us, Christianity most likely is true. There most likely is a God. It's a question of probability. If I say God's existence, let's not even talk about the resurrection, let's just talk about the existence of God. If I say the existence of God is probable, what's the other side of that coin? What else is also possible but not probable? His non-existence. If I say the existence of God is probable, I'm also saying his non-existence is possible. You understand? Yes, John.
That's a presupposition.
That's a presupposition that the non-existence of God is possible. Now, the moment I've made that conclusion about God, that while his existence is probable, his non-existence is possible, am I still defining him as a necessary being?
No.
How am I seeing him? As a what? You use that C word.
Contingent.
As a contingent being. Because it's contingent beings whose existence is either possible or probable, is probable, but not necessarily necessary. That doesn't make any sense. It's contingent beings whose existence is not necessary, who might exist or might not exist. That describes a contingent being. I could exist or not exist. My existence is not necessary. My existence is not necessary to your existence, nor is your existence necessary to mine. So the moment I say that God's existence is probable, I'm redefining God himself.
We just flipped to the other side.
What do you mean by that?
Well, because now we're arguing, but we're saying
well, maybe there is a God, maybe there isn't a God.
Right! That's right, Kathy.
We're basically kind of affirming what they're saying.
Yeah, that's Jason's point.
Exactly.
That's Jason's point. We can't give that ground. First of all, can we justify taking that position from Scripture? What's the Bible's presupposition? Does the Bible ever give us any leeway to say, yeah, God's existence is probable? Mm-hmm. No. The Bible just starts by saying, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So yeah, his existence is necessary, because if he didn't exist, you wouldn't be here.
It doesn't say he might have.
It doesn't say he might have.
Right.
Yeah. Jason, did you raise your hand again?
Yeah, I was just going to say, Sidestep Bruton, he puts it together like, where do you see evidence being presented most often? In a courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
Who is evidence presented to?
A judge.
A judge. When you make that evidentialist argument, who are you making the judge? That unbeliever.
That's right.
And who is on trial?
God.
You cannot do that.
And you can't even put God on trial without redefining him as something less than God.
We have to refuse to put him in trouble.
We're exactly right, everyone. That's right. That's our number one presupposition, like we talked about several weeks ago. The Lord is God. He is my starting point. I don't start by saying his existence is probable, but his non-existence is, although improbable, possible. Mm-hmm. Just a smidgen of a chance he doesn't exist. How do you even begin to put that in an equation? There is a 32% chance God does not exist. Mm. Okay.
Basically, just affirm there's no absolute.
At that point, you have. But we have to connect some dots to get there. John.
Real fast, but there is, just to turn the corner a little bit there, the role of evidence, though, for the Christian can be helpful, though.
And we are going to actually have a session, once we've actually answered Bob's question, we're going to talk about the use of evidence. So Jason's not saying, I'm not saying, Greg Bonson, Saitan Brubeck, no one's saying, oh, we don't ever use evidence. So certainly, but you use it in the right way for the right reason.
Yeah.
You don't use it to say, oh, God's, I'm going to make God into a contingent being.
For the believer, how'd the Bible come about? Well, this is what happened. Here's the evidence we have. Oh, that bolsters my faith. Okay.
Yep.
When you think evidentialism, think Josh McDowell. His book, Evidence Demands a Verdict.
Yeah.
The verdict is a statement of truth, of course.
Yep.
That makes us the judge. Because anytime, if you need evidence to substantiate something, then you put the evidence above whatever it is that you're trying to substantiate.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the evidence. Mm-hmm. Never mind the fact that you can't put somebody on trial unless they exist.
Well, what's Doug Wilson say? Atheism has two major ideas, right?
God doesn't exist, but if he does, I hate him.
Yeah, well, no, not there's no if in there. There is no God, and I hate him. That's how Doug puts it. There is no God, and I hate him. Uh-oh. I don't know anyone who is so militantly opposed to other imaginary characters, right? I hate Gandalf. I can't stand him. He doesn't exist. He's just imaginary. Someone made him up. No one does that. Was there another hand up here that I missed? John, did you have your hand up? No? Okay, everyone. So we haven't gotten to Bob's question yet, an important question, but you understand the relationship between something that's necessary and something that's contingent. And just closing on Jason's point, you understand why we can't let our starting point be granting that God's non-existence might be possible. Everyone understand that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. We'll end on there. Thank you, everybody.